From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air. I'm here from San Francisco while Terry Gross is rusticating this week. Coming up, the literary world from an insider's perspective. Literary agent Richard Curtis has represented many best-selling authors and feels well qualified since he's written some award-winning fiction himself. In his new book, Beyond the Bestseller, he offers a few tips about the business. Later, we hear from nature writer David Raines Wallace. He recently returned to the scene of his earliest encounter with the out-of-doors, a subtropical woodland in Florida named Bulow Hammock. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a recording of chamber music by Mozart, and critic-at-large Laurie Stone gives us her assessment of Just for Laughs, an annual festival of stand-up comedy held in Montreal. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stachow. There are reports that up to 2 million people linked hands across three Soviet Baltic republics today in a huge protest, marking the 50th anniversary of a Nazi-Soviet pact which ended their independence. Church bells rang out across the Baltic republics as crowds gathered to form a human chain more than 375 miles long, linking the main cities of Latvia, Estonia, and Lithuania. In Moscow, the ranks of special riot police, waving clubs and backed by water cannon, broke up a sympathy demonstration by a few hundred people. The TASS news agency said 75 people were detained for breaches of peace and other offenses. South African police fired tear gas at Archbishop Desmond Tutu and several hundred students as they were leaving church today. NPR's John Madison reports.
Nobel Peace Prize winner Archbishop Tutu went to a church in the black township of Guguletu near Cape Town today to persuade students not to risk a confrontation with the police by undertaking a planned protest march. The march was part of a three-week-old defiance campaign that is expected to continue for at least 2 more weeks until South Africa's general election, from which blacks are excluded. The students accepted Tutu's arguments, but as they left the church to go home, police fired tear gas at them without warning. Tutu walked through the tear gas to confront the police, but according to witnesses, the police were unrepentant. Later, Tutu called a news conference to warn that if the police are not restrained, there will be what he called a major disaster. I'm John Madison reporting.
Plainclothes Israeli troops reportedly fired gunshots from unmarked cars, killing a Palestinian activist in Gaza City today. Iyad Brahim Abu Kamal was seizing Israeli-issued identity cards when he was cut down. The Israeli military said their troops, quote, encountered a group of masked youths and implemented the procedure for apprehending suspects. In the Gaza Strip's Rafah Palestinian refugee camp, Israeli troops shot dead an 11-year-old child and wounded 5 residents in day-long clashes between soldiers and stone-throwing protesters. 9 environmental groups have filed suit against Exxon Corporation seeking federal court orders requiring continued cleanup of the Exxon Valdez oil spill this fall and winter. Bud Parker, coordinating attorney for the Legal Defense Fund, says the residue surface cleanup that Exxon has been providing is inadequate because some of the oil has begun to settle.
Oil has gotten into the sands and in a sense become heavier and rolled down under the water so that there's a great deal of subtidal sand oil in areas near shore which are environmentally particularly rich.
Parker says government's hands are tied when it comes to making sure Exxon fulfills its promise. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 27 points to close at 26.78.11. Advances led declines 9-5. This is NPR News. Canadian and American researchers confirmed today that they have identified the defective gene that causes cystic fibrosis. One of the scientists called it one of the most significant discoveries in the history of human genetics. Cystic fibrosis is the most common life-threatening genetic disease in North America. Experts stressed the discovery would not necessarily lead to a cure for the disease. The work was spearheaded by geneticist Lapchi Tsui in collaboration with research teams led by Jack Reardon at Toronto's Hospital for Sick Children and Francis Collins at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. Plans to build the first synagogue in a suburb of Atlanta are moving ahead today after elected officials rejected complaints from some residents who said they didn't want Jews in their neighborhood. More from Ed Hula.
Last week, some Gwinnett County residents began complaining about the zoning request to permit the temple's construction in a residential neighborhood. One woman said the temple would bring strange people into her neighborhood and a threat of violence. but the complaints provoked outcry from Christian religious leaders who say they welcome the synagogue to mostly white and Christian Gwinnett County, with a population of more than a third of a million and one of the fastest-growing communities in the country. In a vote last night, Gwinnett County commissioners passed the rezoning unanimously. Temple organizers say they are ecstatic about the decision, but say they continue to receive threats, including one to burn the temple down. For National Public Radio, this is Ed Hula in Atlanta.
An Algerian expelled from France hijacked an Air France jet with more than 100 people aboard today by threatening to blow up the plane over the Mediterranean, but he was armed only with soap and toilet water and surrendered peacefully. The hijacker, a 30-year-old shopkeeper identified as Jamal, stepped off the Airbus at Algiers Airport and gave an impromptu news conference. Shortly before being arrested, he told journalists he wanted to bring attention to the war in Lebanon.
This is Fresh Air, and I'm Sedge Thompson. Terry Gross is still enjoying her summer vacation. Say you've written a murder mystery. You find an agent. You go to lunch. You talk about the business, not so much about literature. My guest today, Richard Curtis, is a literary agent. He seemed to be working against his own interests when in 1982 he wrote How to Be Your Own Literary Agent. He's once again revealing secrets of the business in his new book, Beyond the Bestseller, A Literary Agent Takes You Inside the Book Business. Curtis worked for many years writing almost any book he could get a contract for, from juvenile biographies to pornography. As an agent, he now represents many genre writers and includes Janet Daly, Steve Allen, and Leonard Maltin as clients. He also writes a monthly advice column for writers in the science fiction magazine Locus. Curtis has watched as major upheavals have taken place in the publishing industry over the past decade, and since he began his career in the early 60s, the number of publishing houses has dwindled from around 75 to 20. Curtis believes as the conglomerates take over, the diversity of our literature is diminishing. He sees a system where the concerns are more financial than literary, a system geared towards star authors and bestsellers at the expense of finding new talent. The few hot authors are paid huge sums, while others are lucky to get a $5,000 advance.
What is stirring all that money up is the urgency, close to desperation, that publishers feel to get a book on the bestseller list to keep that cash flow going, because many publishers are owned by conglomerates that own very profitable companies that make nuts and bolts type things that are used to seeing an annual growth rate of 15 or 20% or more.
So they expect this from their authors.
They expect this from publishers, and the publishers expect it from the authors. So there's tremendous pressure exerted on publishers and therefore on authors to produce and to produce whatever it was that did well last year or last book to do it again. And so either you go lusting after the author that is purported to be the hot new thing this year, or you put pressure on successful authors to repeat and formulaize their last successful book. But what you don't read about, and what I've tried to express in my book, is that the money, a lot of the money to acquire those star authors comes off the backs of the little authors who must struggle at pretty much the same advance price level that they have been earning for the last 10 or 20 years.
How have you as an agent tried to either exempt yourself from the cycle or continue to participate in it?
Well, I don't pretend to be a saint. My job is to make as much money for my clients as possible. And when I have a star author or an author that I think is going to be a star, I'm going to try to get as much money as the market will bear. But I at the same time feel that there are other values that must be considered when we look at the publishing industry. There are some agents who take the attitude that the publisher should be given enough of a break so that publishers can maintain their profit margin so that they can reinvest their profits, hopefully, in developing new authors. Unfortunately, that isn't always the case. What they do with the profits that they make from one star best-selling book is to go out and try to steal yet another star. And so the business has become more star-oriented and more formula-oriented.
Do you read all the manuscripts that come into you?
Well, we like most literary agencies, receive thousands of manuscripts a year. I read just about all of the manuscripts submitted by my professional clients, but when it comes to material submitted by new authors and would-be authors, sometimes you have to perform a kind of literary triage by glancing at material. If it's clearly terrible, then you have to reject it. If it's promising, then you have to take it home and read it, because there's really nobody else to do it for you. We can give it out to our staff, or we can hire readers to do it. But ultimately, when there is promising new material, we have to read it ourselves.
Part of your early career was as a freelance writer. How did you do as a freelance writer?
I did pretty well. I wrote just about anything and everything that sold when I was starting out as a writer. Everything from dirty books, I don't mind telling you, because in those days dirty books were very mild and almost charming in their innocence. I wrote adult books. I wrote humor books. I wrote anything that that was for sale in the marketplace. I think I've lost count, but about 50 books published, because I like many writers I know, work very fast. I can turn a novel in one draft in maybe 30 days. And many of the writers I know, and many of them that I represent, are capable of writing that fast as well. And so it's not surprising to me anyway, but it is to outsiders to learn that some authors have had 300 or 400 books published, and sometimes you don't even know their names because so many of them have been done under pen names. And that was certainly the case with the work that I did. But it was a very good grounding for me to learn from the when I became an agent. My grounding as a writer was very helpful to me in learning how to handle authors and how to speak to authors about their work. Many literary agents and many editors have never tried their hands at writing. And I've often joked that an editor or an agent should have to qualify for a license by writing a novel. Because then they would find out that many of the things that appear incredibly easy are incredibly hard, and vice versa.
But if you were able to churn out a book in, what was it, a week, you said?
No,
a weekend?
I know people who've written books in a weekend, but I would say...
That makes it sound incredibly easy.
I don't think it is not incredibly easy, but, you know, you can almost write in a trance. If you've plotted the book either on paper or in your head, and you set yourself a goal of 10 or 15, 20 manuscript pages a day, then in 15 or 20 days, you have a book-length manuscript. And many people don't have to revise. There is a whole world, what you might call a subculture, of writers who write popular literature, the kind of romances and science fiction, horror, this paperback originals, westerns, that really feed most of the reading habits of the public. And yet the public knows very little about them. They hear about the literary authors who have slaved and suffered over one book over a 10 or 15 year period. But there's a world of writers, freelance writers, many of whom who make excellent livings, who can perform what would appear to be miracles, and yet they take it as very commonplace.
Let's talk about genres for a second. There are genres in literature, mystery, science fiction, western. These rarely make the bestseller list, but they seem to make a substantial living income for the writers and the publishers and for yourself. What is the break-even point nowadays? How many books need to be sold in these genre categories?
Well, before I answer that, I just want to dispute something you said, which is that these books rarely go on the bestseller list. if you look at the bestseller list on any given week, you'll see that many, perhaps most, of the bestsellers are by authors who have emerged from the ranks of romance writers, horror writers, science fiction writers, westerns like Louis L'Amour was a best-selling writer, Danielle Steele, Janet Daly come out of the romance field, Stephen King comes out of the horror field. One of the reasons I love genre writing is because it is a breeding ground for the people who tomorrow are going to be on the bestseller list. To return to your question, a modest sale for a paperback original in one of those categories, such as horror or science fiction or westerns, might be 25,000 to 50,000 copies sold. And then as authors become more and more popular, I would say a respectable sale, a sale where publishers begin to take notice and begin thinking of stealing authors from each other, might be around 100,000 copies sold of a paperback.
My guest today is literary agent Richard Curtis. One of the curious subgenres of writing is the novelization of a book that comes from a movie. And you were the agent for a book that was written by Peter Brian George called Red Alert that became Dr. Strangelove. I wonder if you could explain the convolutions that novelization went through.
Well, it was. I worked at the Scott Meredith Literary Agency at the time it happened, and Peter George had written a very serious novel about what would happen if nuclear fail-safe safeguards failed, and we ended up with the nuclear missiles flying over the continents, and a movie producer. It was published in New York, I believe, by Ace Books. A movie producer liked the book, thought it would make a dandy movie, and acquired it, and discovered that he really couldn't make much of a movie out of it. So he sold it to somebody who sold it to somebody who ended up selling it to Stanley Kubrick. And Kubrick saw the movie in it, but he saw it as this manic statement about the insanity of nuclear armaments, and he made this absolutely whacked out movie called Dr. Strangelove with Peter Sellers, I believe. The movie was so different from the original book that it was based on that they decided to have that book novelized and published as a new novel. Who did they choose to novelize? The original author. So the original author ended up writing a novelization of his own novel, and it was published under a pen name, as I recall, by a different publisher. So you had really two books for the price of one, and based on, you know, that the book was acquired for the film and then novelized in a totally different way.
You also have worked as a novelizer. You made a novelization of John Carpenter's Halloween. What was different for you in doing that from writing one of your other books?
Well, most people think that novelizing, even writers, by the way, not just outsiders, but writers think that novelizing a movie must be very easy. All you do is take the screenplay and write He Said and She Said. And nothing could be further from the truth, because if the movies are seen with a different lobe of the brain than books are read. A short chapter in a book might expand into a 15-minute scene in a movie, whereas perhaps 10 chapters in a book might boil down to 10 seconds in a movie. And so the novelizing of films is an art form that I think is probably not very much appreciated. And I had to novelize Halloween, or Halloween 1, I guess, because there have been many sequels since then, but the original Halloween, and anyone who's seen it may remember that this was about, it starts, there's kind of a prologue, about a little boy who sees his sister dressing or undressing for Halloween, and he goes into the kitchen, gets a long knife, and stabs her to death, and is then thrown in an insane asylum. And the movie proper begins about 20 years later when he escapes from the insane asylum, goes back to the town he came from, and goes on a rampage. So I had to novelize this film, and it presented some very interesting challenges. For instance, this boy had been essentially locked away in an institution for some 20 years, but he escapes by car. And the question arose in my mind, and I knew it was going to arise in the minds of people reading the novel, how did he learn to drive when he was institutionalized for 20 years? So I had to make up this cock and bull story about how he'd become a trustee and had driven a truck around the grounds of the mental institution. nobody complained about it, so I guess they bought it.
Novelizers actually don't earn much money. They get tend to get a flat fee, and in fact, you wrote a novelization for a horror movie called Squirm for a flat fee.
Yeah.
And then it went on to be a bestseller around the world?
Well, there was a horrible, really terrible, horrible horror movie made by a now-defunct company about what happens when there's an electrical storm and a downed electrical wire stimulates worms to come out of the ground and terrorize a town. You know, everybody's fantasy of bloodworms crawling under your skin, and that's just what happened. And I was asked to novelize this film, and because it was such a dumb movie, and I knew I could make $2,500 fast in 10 days, when the publisher said, we don't want to pay you any royalties, I agreed to it. And so I wrote the book in about 10 days, and it did go on to be a very successful book. I believe it may still be in print in England and Japan and elsewhere, but I got my $2,500 and I've never seen another dime.
You needed an agent.
I did, but I don't trust agents.
I'm talking with literary agent Richard Curtis. He writes a column on publishing issues for the science fiction trade magazine Locus, which are now gathered in his book called Beyond the Bestseller. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest today is literary agent Richard Curtis. I see a number of nonfiction books that come in that just seem sloppy in many ways. A lot of extraneous information, not cleanly written, a lot of typographical errors, not even necessarily easy to read. What is happening to editors?
Well, they're owing to the takeover of publishing companies by other publishing companies and by conglomerates and entertainment complexes, what happens is that after a publisher is acquired, the efficiency experts usually say, well, what do we need two publishing companies bidding for the same kinds of stuff? So let's let go of some of our editors. And very often, good, competent editors are let go, particularly senior editors, who come from an era when there was more, perhaps, pride and more time to work on a manuscript and perfect it. And so there has been, in my opinion, a decline. And by the way, it's not only my opinion. I think it's generally accepted that the quality of editorial work performed on manuscripts has become far inferior to what it was 20 or 30 years ago.
This seems to work against the best interests of the book industry, because if books are more difficult to read or even unpleasant to read or a chore, why read a book when you can turn on the electronic TV?
Well, I think that's exactly what is happening. When people have a choice of being entertained in another medium, such as movies or television, if books are not any longer satisfying, or if they become so formalized as to become boring, then people will indeed turn to the many other media that offer more pleasure and possibly for the same amount of money or for none at all, such as television.
From time to time, I read in the newspaper that a major author has decided to switch publishing houses, and there's a great hue and cry about why so-and-so has abandoned one publisher for another. You were involved with some litigation with a former colleague of yours. You sued him for $1 million because he'd left and taken some of the authors of the firm with him to another place. What did you learn as an agent from that experience?
Well, you're talking about two different things. One is loyalty of authors to publishing companies. And I think probably, maybe I'm being nostalgic, but in a bygone era, maybe at least when I came into the business in the 1960s or so, you still had a very strong bond between author and editor. And that bond was paramount. The agent was not as powerful as agents are today, and so the main relationship was between author and editor. But as the business became more and more of a business, editors were either fired or they went lusting after new jobs, and so the editorial turnover reached a frenetic pace, and authors lost their editors sometimes. Every time they wrote a book, they lost their editors. And so the loyalty of authors towards their editors has weakened profoundly over the last few years. And what's taken its place has been a strengthening bond of author to the literary agent, because the agent is here. We were here yesterday and we're here today and presumably we'll be here tomorrow to see the author through all these storms of editorial turnover. So there's been a growing loyalty from on the part of authors towards their agents, and the agents have therefore become even more powerful vis-a-vis the publishers. I did have an employee who represented some clients of the agency, and when he decided to set up for himself, he invited some of them to join him, and some of them did, and I felt it was a disloyal thing to do, and I reached for my lawyer.
Well, thank you very much for coming in and talking with us today.
Thank you.
Richard Curtis runs his own literary agency in New York City. His book, Beyond the Bestseller, A Literary Agent Takes You Inside the Book Business, is published in hardcover by New American Library, a division of Penguin Books USA, Incorporated. I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with sociologist Terry Williams. Over the past 3 years, he's hung out with a teenage cocaine ring in New York City. He details their daily routine in his new book, The Cocaine Kids. I hope you can join us.
If they asked me, I could write a book about the way you walk and whisper and look. I could write a preface on how we met, so the world would never forget. And the simple secret of the plot is just to tell them that I love you a lot.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Sedge Thompson with Fresh Air. The kookaburra is an Australian bird from the parched outback. But when its call is used by Hollywood, the song provides the incidental sound to accompany scenes set in dense, steamy jungles. To writer and naturalist David Raines Wallace, this kind of anomaly is a subtle example of the ever-increasing separation from our earliest origins. On today's Fresh Air, David Raines Wallace talks about rediscovering our evolution. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a recording of what to him are two of Mozart's most beautiful chamber works. And critic at large Laurie Stone assesses the current state of stand-up comedy. She's just returned from the Just for Laughs Festival in Montreal. That's all coming up here on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. A protest involving up to 2 million as people living in three Soviet Baltic republics joined hands. They were marking the 50th anniversary of a Nazi-Soviet agreement in which they lost their independence. Church bells rang out across the Baltic republics as crowds gathered to form a human chain more than 375 miles long. Ann Cooper has more on the story.
Today's rallies protested a 1939 secret pact that led to the Soviet takeover of the Baltic lands of Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia. Masses of people rode bikes and buses out of Vilnius today to line up at the southern end of a chain that nationalist leaders said would stretch throughout the three republics. There were no official reports on the size of the crowds and no reports of any violence. I'm Ann Cooper in Vilnius.
President Bush considers it a positive sign that Soviet leader Gorbachev apparently counseled Poland's communists to take part in the new government in their country. Talking with reporters today, the president also warned that there will be bumps in the road as these countries move toward more democracy. As for the possibility of sending in U.S. troops to help Colombia fight drug cartels, the president said that whole question of troop speculation got out of whack. Administration officials have said that there are no plans to send troops to Colombia, and that country's president does not want them. The hijacking of an Air France Airbus with more than 100 passengers ended today when the lone hijacker surrendered to Algerian police. Larry James reports from Cairo that the hijacker has been identified as a 30-year-old Algerian who is being expelled from France.
The unarmed man, identified as Saeed Jamel, surrendered to Algerian police a little more than an hour after the plane landed. Witnesses said all he had in his possession was a plastic bag which contained a bar of soap and a bottle of perfume. He told journalists as he stepped from the plane he wanted to draw world attention to the situation in Palestine and Lebanon. Reports from Paris said Jamel had worked in France as a merchant, but that he was being expelled for disorderly conduct. He was said to have been very upset at Orly Airport in Paris when French police put him on the plane. An Air France spokeswoman said all those on board the plane were unharmed. For National Public Radio, I'm Larry James in Cairo.
A jetliner from Nigeria had to make an emergency landing after the pilot reported a problem with one of the engines in the Boeing 737. There were 120 people on board the aircraft making a domestic flight. No one was injured. And more layoffs are expected at Eastman Kodak. The company says it's cutting 4,500 jobs and restructuring and selling units with combined annual sales of $1.25 billion. The company says the plan will generate $1 billion. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Of the hundreds of pieces of music Mozart wrote, only a few were written for the combination of string chamber ensemble and winds. But classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz says these works are among Mozart's most beautiful. Today, Lloyd reviews a new recording of two of these ensemble pieces.
Mozart chamber music must be harder to play than it looks. There have been so few recent performances that are truly satisfying. So I'm happy to report that two of my favorite works get marvelous performances on a recent disc. It features the elegant Gabrielli String Quartet, a British group that has consistently impressed me. Mozart's Clarinet Quintet is one of his last chamber works. It was written 200 years ago, just 2 years before Mozart died. It's an autumnal work by a young genius, like Keats's Ode to Autumn. They're both works that accept life by accepting the inevitability that everything ends. And if one aspect of dying can be fruition, if it's possible to achieve some final fulfillment, then maybe death is tolerable. In King Lear, Edgar says to his blind father, "Men must endure their going hence, even as their coming hither. Ripeness is all." I think more than any other composer, including even Mahler, Mozart lets us hear how profoundly beautiful the sadness of a farewell can be. Listen to the beginning of the Larghetto, the sublime slow movement of the clarinet quintet. A happy ending might seem unlikely, arbitrary after this music, but the almost childlike joy with which Mozart ends the clarinet quintet seems completely convincing. For all its difficulties, this music has to seem effortless. It's about the joy of a rich harvest, what comes after all the work. Both the Gabrielis and their excellent clarinetist Keith Putty know this, and their performance has just the right quality of artless, unpretentious simplicity behind all the sophistication. That is its sophistication. Mozart wrote his clarinet quintet, clarinet trio, and clarinet concerto for his friend Anton Stadler, who must have been an amazing musician. The clarinet was still a new instrument, and it's easy to imagine how stimulated Mozart must have been by it to compose such gorgeous pieces. The other work on this album is the Oboe Quartet, composed 8 years earlier. It's a pastoral work with only glimmerings of the clouds that darken the clarinet quintet. But it's impossible to begrudge Mozart his moments of pure happiness, especially when that happiness bubbles over with such invention and charm. And the oboe's aria in the central slow movement has something deeper. It's almost in awe of its own beauty. Douglas Boyd is the oboist here with the Gabrielli String Quartet. With such deep moments, these works earn the sheer virtuoso joy of their finales. In Mozart's greatest works, virtuosity is never an end in itself. Beauty and joy are things that have to be taken seriously because they are never without their cost.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor for the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed a new MCA recording of the Gabrielli String Quartet and soloist performing Mozart's clarinet quintet and oboe quartet. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. The earliest form of nature writing is the myth. Successors to the early storytellers have included Dame Juliana Burns, the abbess who wrote a guide to trout fishing that was later cribbed by Isaac Walton as The Complete Angler. In the past century, Emerson, Muir, Isley, and Hegg Brown honed the nature essay form. It's a form that's attracted many writers and readers as a means of getting back to nature, if you will. California writer David Raines Wallace also ruminates about the out of doors. His books include The Klamath Knot, a collection of essays, and The Turquoise Dragon, a thriller involving kidnapped endangered species. His latest book, Bulow Hammock, is his reflection on his return to a swampland in Florida he explored as a boy. I ask Wallace what inspired him to write about the out of doors.
I've always been interested in nature. I grew up in Connecticut, in a rural area for the first, from about ages 3 to 5, and somehow acquired a kind of a magical view of nature that I didn't get much chance to sort of exercise after my family moved to the suburbs, but it was always sort of there underneath. And I think the main influence that got me started writing was coming to the West Coast. I'd never really encountered wilderness before, as we have it here. Growing up in New England, there's a lot of little second growth trees, but you don't have the great redwoods and pines and large wilderness areas that you do here. So that was a revelation to me. It was a revelation to be able to row out in Tamales Bay and off Point Reyes and see herds of sea lions and harbor seals.
One of the reactions that people from the East have to going to California is the perceived lack of seasons, which, of course, if you live in California, you know is just not the case at all. There are very distinct seasons. But many people see it as kind of a year-round summertime. What was your reaction as an East Coast person to the climate changes that you saw between East and West of this continent?
Well, of course, the dryness is the main thing. And I think that I found that fascinating. In New England, everything is either covered with snow or covered with green leaves. And I found the wide-open spaces of the West very inviting. You have a feeling of great space, of being able to move out into a very adventurous, interesting experiences that you don't have so much in the East. It's more of kind of a closed-in feeling there. So I think that aspect of it is very important. I miss thunderstorms and other aspects of the East. Which is one reason I wrote this book, Bulow Hammock. It was sort of a return to Eastern roots in a way for me after the experience of the Western wilderness, kind of a plugging back into of the experiences I'd had in the Western wilderness back into the kind of places I'd grown up with as a child.
Bulow Hammock is a place in Florida, very
yes.
Very swampy, filled with creatures that you'd otherwise not see in the West.
Mm-hmm. One of the reasons I went back was that, you know, as I said, I'd spent a lot of time in the wilderness out here in the West, and had, had a very positive attitude toward it. I had, the idea, as many people do, that I was sort of escaping from the anxieties of civilization by going out into these great wilderness areas and writing about them. My idea was simply to go out and experience these areas and enjoy them, write about them, and thereby try to help to encourage people to protect them. Somewhere along the way, I ran into a problem in that I started having anxiety attacks in the middle of the wilderness, which was a surprise to me. I began to wonder about my mind. We kind of take our minds for granted in a way. We assume that they're like a computer, a bunch of circuits that we program with experiences and information, and then that programming will help us to do what we want. But increasingly, the evidence of science is that the mind is not so much a computer as a program, and that is that it's not a it's not a blank slate of circuits that you just fill up with your own experiences. It's full of a lot of innate programming that goes back to a very old. The mind is an evolutionary phenomenon rather than a technological one. So, the mind is a kind of a paradigm of evolution in a way, in that it's the lowest part of the human mind is a mind that we share with reptiles and other animals, and then as different layers build up on the mind, you start getting consciousness closer to the human, to the more conscious primate consciousness. So it gave me second thoughts about what I was doing out there in the wilderness. I think Below Hammock as a book is an inquiry into the relationship between the mind and nature. And when I started having these experience anxiety attacks in wilderness, it's kind of it's very anxious to have an anxiety attack in a wilderness area when you're 2 miles from the nearest two days walk from the nearest roadhead, and you're spending a night in this kind of a terrified condition, which is not rational. There wasn't any reason for me to be afraid, but I was anyway. So I thought it would be interesting and maybe helpful to go back into the mind and into wild nature, into my own experience of wild nature, and into an earlier time. I thought that this swamp, which I'd experienced as a small child when I was 9, and had felt some fear of at that time. When I was a child, I wasn't really afraid of nature, but that particular place seemed wilder and more complicated and stranger, in a way more savage than any other place I'd experienced growing up in New England. It was like with full of alligators and poisonous snakes.
Was this what provoked your anxiety attacks?
I don't know what provoked my anxiety attacks. I suspect that one of the things that may prompt the feelings of anxiety that civilized people have is a kind of fear of getting lost. We've come so far from our origins, from our evolution, with our great cities and all our cultural complication that we've got, that sometimes I think we have a feeling that we're kind of lost in space.
There's a section of Below Hammock that I'd like us to hear.
This is when I was just beginning to venture in, when I was first started visiting the hammock in the early 1980s. Although it was fall, the hammock was full of mosquitoes and ticks, and chiggers, as I realized later, when their bites started itching. There were vast numbers of orb weaver spiders, at least one to every bush. I kept walking into the webs and into the spiders, huge yellow ones, 6 inches across with hairy legs, pink and green ones that looked like flower buds, gold and white ones with spine-covered abdomens. One of the huge ones, called a golden web spider, had caught a young Anole lizard in its web, had wrapped it in silk, and was eating the flesh of the head. The lizard's white skull gleamed strangely from the gray web.
When you see a sight such as that, does it lock into your vision so that you're able to set it down later? Or do you take notes on it as you see it? Or does it haunt you at night as an image?
Well, it locks in pretty well, a sight like that. You don't see sights like that very often in nature. Predation like that it doesn't happen all the time. Of course, it does happen all the time, but you just don't see it that much. So seeing a spider eat a lizard is a very unusual sight. So I remembered that very well. I didn't have to take any notes of that.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have any bad dreams about it. I tend to have bad dreams about people, not animals.
One of your essays makes an observation about the nature of animal sounds that we hear in soundtracks on television and movies, that it becomes mm-hmm. kind of a generic nature sound, like the sound of the wren-tit is the only bird sound we ever hear in movies, or the kookaburra in eerie jungle scene.
The kookaburra is a kind of kingfisher that lives in fairly dry eucalyptus woodland in Australia, so it's... When you're actually in the jungle, like in Central America, where I've been, you don't hear that at all. You hear things like tinamous, which are these little sort of chicken-like birds that have this beautiful kind of eerie whistling sound that they make. It's sort of It sounds like Rima the Bird Girl or something. It's not at all the kind of savage sound that you would expect in a jungle movie. It's something much more lovely and delicate, and which most of the things in jungles are rather lovely and delicate.
How do you react to this kind of generic ecosystem that's put out in films and television?
Well, it's interesting. It makes watching television interesting because it's just funny to listen to a wren-tit song, which a wren-tit is a bird that's endemic to California chaparral, doesn't live anywhere else. But you can hear it in movies about like the Scottish Highlands, or there's a lot of wren-tit songs in the old Flash Gordon movies about the planet Mongo, Ming of Mongo, you know, that all that stuff. And there'll be these giant scorpions running around, and then you'll hear a wren-tit singing in the background. I mean, it's funny. It also shows how lost, again, to get back to that metaphor, our civilization is in terms of natural ecosystems. I mean, people just have no idea sort of where they are in real ecological terms.
Thank you very much for coming and being with us on Fresh Air today.
Thank you for having me.
Bulow Hammock, Mind in a Forest, the new book by David Raines Wallace, is published by Sierra Club Books. This is Fresh Air. Coming up later here on National Public Radio is today's edition of All Things Considered. Host Noah Adams has stopped by to tell us what's in the show today. Noah?
Hi, Sedge. Coming up, in the Soviet Union, there was a human chain today along a route almost 400 miles across the republics of Estonia and Latvia and Lithuania, the so-called captive nations. People in those countries getting together to protest the Soviet annexation of the countries 50 years ago today, and a call for independence from Moscow. We'll have a report from NPR's Ann Cooper. Also, an update on the issue of global warming and whether the dangers of burning the fossil fuel should be reconsidered in favor of nuclear power. The arguments for and against presented by NPR's Richard Harris.
Thanks very much for the report, Noah. We'll look forward to All Things Considered later here on National Public Radio. Every summer, Montreal hosts a two-week bilingual stand-up comedy festival called Just for Laughs. Our critic-at-large Laurie Stone attended this year's convention and came away wondering, what's so funny?
The Just for Laughs Festival is an international comedy supermarket, circus, and schmooze marathon, and it's the biggest event of its kind. It mounts the work of over 100 English and French-speaking acts and attracts powerful talent brokers from the club scene, TV, and Hollywood. Right now, comedy is the biggest grossing segment of the entertainment industry. This kind of popularity should mean there's room for experiment, and there is some in the clubs on both U.S. coasts. Just for Laughs has it in its power to support innovation and diversity. This year, the organizers claimed that attention had been paid to downplaying Take My Wife jokes and including women and minorities. Their attention must have wandered. The performers are mostly straight white men. Out of 53 English-speaking acts, there are 4 black men and 7 women. There are no black women, no Asians, no Latinos, and no out gays. The black performers are tame. 2 don't even do stand-up, but rather variety acts. And as for the women, the bimbo factor is overpowering. Victoria Jackson of Saturday Night Live fame stands pigeon-toed in a short ballerina dress and squeaks out a charmless song about being dumb. 3 other women look like they're stealing her act. The festival has made me think about why diversity is so important. Without fresh blood and alternative angles of vision, comedy ratifies itself rather than stirring, disturbing, arguing. The goals inspiring the richest humor are the same steering all narrative, to say what is usually suppressed and also speak truthfully. The words that are usually suppressed are those that defy established values, undermine bases of power. To speak truthfully, a performer has to strip off defenses. In other words, forego his or her alliance with authority. Laughter isn't deliberated, but rather bursts forth almost always from a sense of wickedness. We want to see lunatics running the asylum, those who've been kicked doing the stomping. Most of the 43 white males who take the mic at Just for Laughs do the opposite. They reassure audiences that their bigotries are truths. The humor of sweaty, overweight Lenny Clark turns on the proposition that his wife is lucky to have him, and he's fortunate to get away from her. He raises his aggression on a flagpole, then slinks into the role of victim. Alan Thicke tells pathetically unfunny girl jokes to point up the primitiveness of his hometown. Jokes like, the best-looking girl was inflatable. Jokes like, a girl who was 5 months pregnant was considered a virgin. Rick Overton fires witty salvos at Ollie North, but then wishes on him the worst punishment that can befall a man. In Overton's view, sex with another male. He wants North in jail, sharing a cell with a swish black guy big as a linebacker. Fear of anal penetration hums through the festival like an anthem. These kinds of comics, wherever they appear, pretend to bash taboos by saying what most people think but are too inhibited to blurt out. But by attacking groups that are already buffeted in the culture, principally women and gays, these performers suck up to authority. Audiences get the pleasure of hating, but they're invited to cave into their fears, not feel startled by them.
Laurie Stone is a New York-based writer and critic and is a contributor to The Village Voice. Amy Sallet and Phyllis Myers produced the interviews on Fresh Air. Our research interns are Andrew Kaplan, Liz Trubert, and the resourceful Hillary Goldhammer, who's on the road back to Vassar. We wish her well. I'm Sedge Thompson.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Next time, a report from the streets about the crack and cocaine that's polluting America's youth. I speak with sociologist Terry Williams, who spent years hanging out with teenage coke dealers. Also, we explore the lives of Asian immigrants and their children in the United States. I'm Sedge Thompson, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.